The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
Welcome, everyone. I'm so happy to introduce Andy Olensky, who is the senior scholar and executive director at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies out in the middle of Massachusetts, where there's a secondary triple gem, the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, and on the same campus is the Forest Refuge and Insight Meditation Society. And it's really one of the great supporting institutions for all of these smaller groups like what we have here in Minneapolis. And Andy was part of IMS. He was the executive director, I'm not sure of the years, in the late 80s and 90s? Early 90s?
Early 90s,
And many of you know the IMS, the practice there, and so many people have benefited from the long retreats that people like Andy and the teachers that have taught those retreats. And now the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies is a wonderful place for both study and practice. A number of people here have been there. You should go to the website, dharma.org, and you can see the wonderful offerings, some of which Andy teaches, and then there are many other teachers from different Buddhist traditions teaching there. And it's just a wonderful institution and incredibly beautiful. And I think Andy's been part of just the aesthetic of the place, built in an old New England farmhouse, and then other buildings added to it, but all fitting in a very beautiful way that you walk in and you feel really calm. That's how I feel whenever I'm there. It's really great. So thanks, Andy, for being here. Really great to have you.
My pleasure.
You know, it feels a little bit like this place. I was just admiring when I came in that the aesthetic we've been trying to create in Barry is what I call Shaker Zen. Partly because of its New England roots, but here, you know, you've brought a lot of the touches of Japanese aesthetic, and you know, the light openness is wonderful. It's only been about 20 years since I first went out to Barry, but in that 20 years, what a change we've seen. Groups like this, I think, would have been unheard of back then. Just to see so much interest in the Dharma, so much enthusiasm for the practice, and so many people really coming together to support one another in the investigation of experiences. It's a wonderful thing. So I'm happy to be invited to come here today. I am passing through town, and I thought since I were here, what I would do is first I would talk for maybe 45 minutes or an hour on what I guess what I'd like to talk about is what I think is the core insight of Buddhism, the primary teaching, the most important aspect of it all. And I'll share with you my best understanding of that. And then I also want to allow plenty of time afterwards for questions and discussion and so forth, either about what I've said or about anything else. I want to try to be as much a resource for you as I can while I'm here this afternoon. There are many ways that we have to look at the mind these days. And there's a growing field, as you know, of neuroscience, and a particularly interesting and exciting subset of this field is the interface between Buddhist thought, classical Buddhist thought, and understanding of the mind. Part of that has to do with the overlap with brain science. Part of it has to do with contemporary psychologies and psychotherapies and so forth. Some of it has to do with philosophy of mind. The Buddhists, I think, bring a very unique perspective to consciousness, to experience, to mental events that the contemporary scientists are really ready for. Maybe it's taken this long for Western scientific tradition to develop to a point where it can appreciate and gain from what the Buddhists have explored and found out about the mind in their 2,500-year tradition. And it's not just one way. I mean, Buddhists are learning from the scientists as well. It's a very fertile interface right now. But by and large, the Western maps or models of the mind and of the brain tend to be third person. They're looking at it from the outside. psychologists and scientists are generally studying other people, other people's behaviors, other people's scanning and imagery, and trying to understand the mind in that way. We have, you know, the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere. We have models of sort of the reptilian brain and the mammalian brain and then the neocortex. We have maps that lay out, you know, the gray matter where all the neurons are and then all the supporting apparatus, which is the majority of what's in our head. Things that bring in blood vessels and create coverings for the nerves and so forth. We have, of course, that very fancy map of very clever Latin ways of saying the upper left-hand part and the back right squiggly part and that little part that looks like an almond. You know, all those descriptions of the brain. In ancient India, really from a very early age, I mean, going back thousands of years, there was a strong tradition of looking at the mind directly through introspection. And I don't think it's stretching the matters too far to say that it was following a protocol of empirical observation and investigation. That for the large part, the early yogis, those people in probably certainly 1,000, probably 2,000, maybe even 3,000 BCE, were sitting down under a tree alone, closing their eyes, putting their back straight, and looking deeply into what is it that's happening right here and now? What's arising? What can I understand about the nature of the human condition from what I'm seeing directly in front of me? Now, what I want to emphasize today is that we really have two different ways of using the mind to understand the world. One of those ways has to do with the mind as a tool, consciousness as a tool, for serving up direct experience. What exactly is happening in my environment right now, taking in visual data, auditory data, and many other sense doors, to gain awareness, consciousness, of what's happening right here and now. Events are occurring. Data is streaming in through the sense doors and so forth. But then a great deal of our mental activity actually goes into a very different pursuit, and that is making sense of that. You know, an awful lot of what constitutes our lived experience has to do with building up and holding together and modifying a very complex conceptual overlay to that data. We have features of perception and language and symbolism and so forth that creates for ourselves a mental picture of what the significance of that data is. We're generally not spending much of our mental time and energy in processing what's coming in through the door at any given moment. Most of the time, we're taking that data and fitting it into this large conceptual model. What does this mean for me? You know, where am I right now? What am I going to do on Tuesday? And do I have to stop at the store and pick up, you know, such and such? And so forth. We're constantly using language, using symbolic representation, using imagination to process the data coming in through the door in a way that is fitting into a model that we carry with us. And this model is important. It helps us, you know, have experience that goes beyond the moment and can create order over multiple mind moments. But what was so unique about early Buddhist psychology, early Indian psychology, was a very strong emphasis upon the former way of using the mind rather than upon the latter. They didn't really trust and were not that interested in modifying the conceptual overlay as much as they were interested in exploring very directly and very experientially the actual flow of information coming in the present moment into experience. And that's a lot of what Buddhist meditation is all about. A lot of what we do, what we did just now in sitting here, is to temporarily, just for half an hour, we still have to hold our lives together and all, but for half an hour, just let go of putting our attention into holding the conceptual model together and drop down below that level of macro construction to the phenomenology of the moment, to what is it that's actually arising in experience right now. Not what's arriving in my life or my narrative or my story or my schedule. What's arising in the sense doors? The whole first foundation of mindfulness, of course, is mindfulness of the body. What are the actual physical sensations that are occurring when I take an in-breath, or when I make an out-breath, or when I walk carefully moment to moment, lifting, moving, and placing the foot? Every time I start thinking about what that means, I let go of that, and I return to what is the actual sensation? What does it feel like? What is the nuances of changing experience? And the second foundation of mindfulness, of course, gets into the feeling tone. Everything comes with a slightly pleasurable or displeasurable feeling tone. Let's notice that dimension of experience, and so forth. Now, primarily, what the Buddhists are exposing when they drop down to the level of direct lived experience in the moment is a kind of model of what consciousness is. What is this experience of knowing that lies at the heart of everything that we do and say and think? Well, it turns out that, you know, they build their understanding of the world from the inside out. From instead of, you know, starting with a story, you know, this is how the world started, and this is the plan for it, and this is what happened, and this is the institutions and the people and the roles and the castes and so forth. And then at the end of all that, there's the individual. This is how the individual fits into all of that. It's all ordered by the story, by the narrative. Instead, they start from the raw experience of conscious awareness and build a sense, an understanding of the world from that, from the inside out. So it starts by simply asking the question, what is consciousness? What is awareness? What is it to be present? What do you notice when you become present? Well, when one becomes present, one is basically noticing the arising and falling of moments of consciousness. Now, consciousness they use as a verb, not a noun. Consciousness isn't a thing that exists. It's an event that happens. It's an episode that occurs. Consciousness arises when certain sense organs come in contact with certain sense objects. The coming together of those two with awareness is what consciousness consists of. What's really unique about this way of looking at things is that it really sees consciousness as arising as a natural phenomenon in the natural world. It's not something sacred. It's not something transcendent. It's not something outside of time and space. It's not something outside of the matrix of cause and effect. It's as natural as anything else in the world. And so many other traditions have come at it from the other direction. They start with creating the idea of consciousness as something transcendent, and then they organize everything around that. The Buddhists really started by the simple, natural experience of being aware of something in the moment. Recognize that to be a natural feature of the human condition and of the world we live in, and then build an understanding, well, how do we find meaning as human beings within the naturalness of consciousness? Well, first we've got to explore the parameters of it. Well, what is this consciousness? How does it manifest? What different modes does it come in? And it turns out, of course, that we notice through empirical observation that consciousness seems to be tied very directly to the senses of the mind and body. The five traditional senses that we know, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the body. And then in Indian tradition, they had a sixth sense of the mind. Mental cogitation is a sort of sense organ in their way of looking at things. So it turns out that consciousness is simply an episode of knowing or being aware, but awareness is the kind of word that needs an object. you can't just be aware. You're always aware of something. And that's, of course, one of the first things we learn here in this practice. You know, you're aware of that sound or that physical sensation or that thought arising. That it's always awareness of something. Now, I know in later forms of Buddhism, they talk about pure awareness or awareness that takes no object and so forth. But in the earliest phase of Buddhism from which I'm speaking, awareness always co-arises with an object of some sort. And furthermore, consciousness or awareness, words I'm using synonymously here, will always arise in dependence upon one of the organs. In other words, we can only see a form by using the apparatus of our eye, the whole optic apparatus. We can only hear a sound. We're only aware of that fan or that siren or some sort of sound because we have a functioning ear system. There's the eardrum and the little, you know, bones and the hairs and the whole wiring in the brain of the auditory cortex that allows us to process and take in this data. So a lot of meditation and a lot of Buddhist analysis of experience starts with getting us out of the story about what's going on and getting us into the lived experience of what's going on. And just noticing moment after moment the arising of this sound that's being heard using the apparatus of the ear. And if I cover my ears, the quality of the sound changes. If I close my eyes, if I do that, the sound of my voice changes. If I close my eyes, then, you know, that changes. And so there's a natural interaction going on here. This is simply when certain things arise, certain other things co-arise with it. When the eye is working and forms come into its view and you've got the right, you know, frequency of light and so forth, and you're not, you know, in a coma or asleep or otherwise distracted by something else, then what is arising is a moment, just a fleeting instant of seeing, of being aware of a visual object, and so forth for all the other senses. Now, the reason it's fleeting, the reason it's changing all the time, is because it's an event. It's something that happens, and everything that happens comes and goes. A moment of knowing arises and passes away. As we know, the human mind is working very quickly, the neurons are firing very quickly, and so these moments of knowing come in rapid succession. And so we know, you know, we see something, we hear something, we think something, we feel something, we see something, we hear something, we feel something, again and again and again. And as we also know, that if you take a snapshot of a picture of something, and you project it quickly enough, it will merge into a cinematographic image. It'll turn into a story. The mind will connect the dots and make an episode into a narrative. We'll take these moments of awareness and string them together into a storyline. And largely, what we consist of, our individuality, our self, our identity, is a storyline. A series of strung together moments of awareness that are organized using certain conceptual apparatus to help us provide some continuity for it all. Now, that's okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. We sometimes think in the West that if we don't have a transcendent explanation of everything, then we're somehow doomed or bereft or, you know, without solace. But again, this more natural spirituality that I think is coming out of ancient India is really inviting us to recognize that this sort of effervescent expression of our existence is okay. It's like everything else in the cosmos. And it's unreasonable and maybe even deluded of us to think it could be or should be otherwise. You know, we are just part of a natural system of arising and passing away things, and that's okay. So then the question becomes, well, how do we find meaning within that? I mean, how do we work with that being the way things are in a way that cultivates well-being, that brings out the best of our nature rather than the worst, that helps us contribute to helping one another, make the world a better place, and so forth. In other words, how do we use this sort of effervescent model of consciousness to not slip into some sort of nihilistic despair, but instead to step up to some really caring and perceptive and intuitive way of living our lives, along principles that are helpful to ourselves and others. Well, the analysis goes further. It goes beyond these six sense doors, these six modes of consciousness that are arising and passing away in rapid succession. And the Buddhists bring in this notion of five aggregates. So between the six sense doors and the five aggregates, you basically have a matrix of experiential occurrences. It's a map of experience, if you will. On the one hand, every moment of knowing is going to be based on one of the sense doors. It's going to be knowing a visual object, knowing an auditory object, knowing a tangible object, knowing a mind object. And the way that we know these things comes in these five different sort of modes. One is materiality. The material form aspect of all reality is foundational in early Buddhism. They're not trying to explain it away or say that it's totally an illusion. There is some stuff here. There's stuff that our body is made out of. There's stuff that the objects in the room are made out of. And, you know, that's okay too. Materiality is an important aspect of mentality. Mind and body are interdependent. They co-create one another. Again, this is unusual in most ways of thinking. Either, you know, consciousness and soul is first, and materiality is just sort of a creation that comes afterwards, as in most religious traditions, or as in the scientific explanation, matter and materiality is primary, and consciousness develops as an afterthought when neurons develop to a certain level of complexity. The Buddhists aren't looking at it from that storyline. They're saying, in this moment of lived experience, mind and body are equally important. One is not dependent upon the other. They are mutually dependent upon each other. That is to say, one is not more primary than the other, but they are equally codependent. We can't use that phrase in interdependent. The other aspect of experience that will present itself to anyone who notices, who tries to notice, as I mentioned before, is the feeling tone. That this apparatus of the body that we have, that not only supports the sense doors, that allows for conscious awareness, it also presents a co-arising with every moment of consciousness, a feeling tone, a tendency to either have something feel pleasurable or unpleasurable. There's also a third, as you know, a neutral feeling tone. And it's hard to say sometimes whether, I've heard it explained both ways, either all feeling is basically neutral, except for some that are obviously very pleasurable or obviously very painful. And I've heard other people explain it that really all feeling is either painful or pleasant, but we often aren't closely aware enough of the sensation to be able to determine. So a neutral feeling tone is when we're not really sure if it's pleasant or unpleasant. It's neither. But if we paid careful enough attention and looked at it ever more closely, as one done in a meditation retreat, for example, one can see it resolving itself eventually into something subtly pleasant or unpleasant. Either way, this pleasant or unpleasant strand that runs through our experience is really what gives us a sense of embodiment, a sense of not just being a computer or some information processing system. Well, every moment of awareness that we process this information, it means something to us. We're invested in it, you know? When something feels bad, we want to get out of that situation and change it somehow. When something feels good, we feel immensely gratified, and we like to indulge that, if possible, hold on to it, or duplicate it. It's not a neutral system. It's a system that provides this juiciness of a feeling tone. And that's an important dimension of every single moment's awareness. The third dimension, the third aggregate, is this perception. You know, that the mind also has associative areas of the brain around the visual cortex, around the auditory cortex. It has way of storing information from previous experience. It has ways of making sense of what it is that's being seen or heard or touched. That we can't help every moment of putting some sort of explanatory shape to a moment seen. Some of this is done by language, you know, where we, in these conceptual maps I started talking about. We use language to define and describe and delineate the world we live in, and each moment's experience is defined, you know, one way or another. As you know, one of these models of the brain is saying one whole half of the brain handles all the linguistic overlay, whereas the other, you know, deals more of a direct experience. But even if it's not overtly linguistic, even if we don't use a specific word to describe something, there are still ways in which the brain is parsing out the information that's coming through the sense doors at any given moment and figuring out what this means to us, how this fits in to our previous experience, what its implications are for future experience, and so forth. You will notice if you try very hard in practice that it's really not that easy, and maybe not even possible at all, to have a so-called raw or unmediated experience. Sometimes the perceptual overlay can be very strong, and sometimes it can be very, very subtle. But according to this model of mind, there's always some way in which we are knowing what it is that we're seeing or hearing or touching. Even if we can't put words on it, there's still a way in which we know that it's not, for example, something threatening, or else all kinds of automatic defense mechanisms would kick in, and so forth. The consciousness itself, as the fourth of these aggregates, the awareness itself, is just a moment of knowing. It's a moment of cognition. And this is, again, something quite unique in Buddhism. As I mentioned, it doesn't make of consciousness something very special. And furthermore, it doesn't make of consciousness something very personal. Consciousness is merely a function. When an object and an organ come into a certain contact, then information is generated. One of the Sanskrit words used to describe consciousness in later tradition, vijñapti, really has its origins in a word that means an announcement. It's like when a king is in his hall and some messenger runs in and announces that so-and-so is, you know, invading at the border, or so-and-so's, you know, crop didn't come in, or whatever. So maybe consciousness is just information being declared. It's just a kind of report on what's happened. Dare I even say maybe it's a memo. You know? It's really just the mind and body sending us memos saying, you know, this is going on. This is happening. An apple is in front of us. You know, the window is open. The ambulance is going by. Warning, notice, notice. But there's nothing particularly meaningful per se in becoming aware of an object. That, in other words, what I'm trying to say is that the mechanism that allows us to be conscious in experience of perceived objects is really a natural phenomenon that is just delivering information. And the way your mind does it and the way my mind does it is not particularly different. That the consciousness itself is not the seat of our individuality. It's not the seat of our uniqueness, and it's not something outside the natural order. So where does our uniqueness come in? Well, this fifth aggregate is this sense of formations, as they call it, sankhara. And that aggregate has to do with several things. It has a manifestation in the past and the present and the future. In the future, formations has to do with the decisions that we make, the choices, the volition that initiates action, our intention to do something. You know, at what point we actually decide to, you know, move our finger or stand up from the cushion and open the door or whatever. There's some executive function in the mind that is putting things into action. putting the body into action, putting the mind into action towards a certain goal or with a certain intention or a certain act of will. So that's one way in which we form or create what's going to happen next. We have some ability to make decisions and then to act on those decisions. We know that from experience. That's not coming from consciousness in this model. That's coming from formations or volition. The present tense sense of this word, sankhara, is more of action, activity. Sankhara, as a word, is directly related to the word for karma. And so karma simply means action. It's what we do. It's what we do with our body. It's what we do with our speech. It's what we do with our mind. This form, this aggregate, is that which puts our mind and body into action and then undertakes that action. And of course, there's going to be a correspondence between what we intend to do and what we do. Every action is going to be prompted somehow. It's going to be initiated somehow. Maybe it's going to be initiated by an automatic response when something happens. Maybe it's going to be initiated in a very conscious way where we deliberately, intentionally, consciously make a decision to do something. Or more often, much more often, what we decide to do is unconsciously generated, unconsciously triggered. And we're not consciously aware of it in the colloquial sense of that word. But still, these intentions are guiding our actions, and then our actions are being carried out. And then in the last sense, of the third sense of this word, sankhara, or formations, has to do with the effect in the past. In other words, every time we've made an action, we've laid down a disposition, or a habit, or some sort of character trait, or personality pattern. And it's based on an accumulated bundle of these that we build up a unique personality, a unique character, a unique set of habits, a unique set of learned behaviors, of conditioned responses, and so forth. And so there's this loop that goes on. Based on what we've done in the past, we have a disposition to act in certain ways, and then when a stimulus comes up, we have the intention to act based on our dispositions, and then based on our intentions, it gets acted out in the present moment, and that lays down another disposition. So there's a sense in which what we call ourself or our personality is this work in progress. We consist of the residue of everything we've thought and done, and then based upon this residue of everything we've thought and done, we can act creatively in any given moment to further the pattern, further the system. What we tend to get good at, we want to do and we continue to do better. What we do inadvertently that we find hurts us, we'll often recreate patterns of behavior so that we won't do that in the future, and so forth. That's the part that's moving and changing and growing with each one of us. The consciousness, the materiality is just sort of a background, a stage upon which all the drama is occurring. Then the perception, the feeling, and the consciousness is really just bringing information, what's going on in this moment? How do I understand what's happening? And then it's the formations, both in terms of volition, in terms of action, and in terms of disposition, that is really shifting and shaping who we are and who we become over our lifetimes. That's the part that's always malleable. So this is a model that the Buddhists are spinning out based upon direct experience. And as you know, the Buddha says, you know, don't take his word for it, don't take it on faith, but try it out in your own experience. And by and large, the guidelines for Vipassana meditation are there to help you see each one of these as it's functioning in your daily life and in your practice on the cushion. I mentioned the first foundation of mindfulness, getting us out of our head and out of the narrative and into the body, what's actually going on. That breaks the habit of thinking too much that some of us have. And the feeling gets us in touch with, you know, what is the flavor, so to speak, of every moment's experience? What's feeling good and not so good? The third foundation is bringing us more into contact with the sense of formations, of intentions. With what quality of mind are we taking a breath? Are we taking a step? Is it a mind that is somehow resisting what's happening? With a mind that's got some aversion laced to it, that doesn't like the sound or the temperature of the room or the fact that the bell hasn't gone off yet or whatever? Or is it a mind moment that is laced with a kind of attachment, a kind of desire? You know, boy, this feels really good. I'm doing really well. I want to keep doing this. Or is it a mind moment that's really confused, that's spaced out, that's maybe daydreaming, that has to be gently returned to the breath, for example? You know, it's starting to ask the question, what is the quality of consciousness that is arising moment to moment as you are tending to what's coming up through the doors, the mind doors? And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness, as some of you know who may have looked at it, is really a tour de force. It's going through all five hindrances. It's going through all five aggregates, all six sense doors, all seven factors of awakening, and all four noble truths. One by one, it takes each of those things and says, notice when, let's pick one, the hindrance of lethargy is arising. You know, when you're getting sleepy, when you're getting tired. Notice when you're feeling a little tired and sleepy and drowsy, low energy. And then it says, notice when that's not happening. Notice when you don't feel drowsy. And you know, right there, you're bringing a close, heightened awareness to the quality of formations, the quality of sankhara, the quality of volition, of intention, of how you're holding yourself in the moment. You're bringing your attention to that. Is there laziness happening or not? And sometimes there is, and sometimes there isn't. It's a changing state. Is lethargy, having not been there, notice when it arises. And notice when it passes away. Notice how you can either cultivate it or abandon it. And when the lethargy is abandoned, notice how it changes experience. And again, there are moments that we all have in the middle of a sitting, perhaps, when we're feeling kind of, you know, sleepy and dopey and so forth, and we kind of, you know, pick ourselves up and say, well, wait a minute, I'm going to reestablish the mindfulness. You know, I'm going to, you know, come back with a little bit more enthusiasm, a little more energy. The fourth foundation of mindfulness is asking us to notice the difference, notice the change in experience. What did it feel like? What did the mind feel like? What did experience feel like when you were feeling a little sleepy? And then what did it feel like when you perked up? And it might happen it gets sleepy again. Notice that. And I just use that randomly. I mean, you can say the same thing about the subtle aversion or resistance that you have to things arising, you know, the pain in your knee or the coughing in the room or whatever. Or, you know, any of the other hindrances. It's also asking us to look at each of the five aggregates. Look at when the material form aspect of experience. Notice the resistance that you feel on your buttocks or from your clothes or you know, anywhere where you feel the world pushing back on your body. You know, that's an experience point, a place of experiential awareness that you can focus on. Notice when that's there, and notice how that experience of resistance arises and how it passes away. Arises and passes away. And same thing for the other aggregates. It's inviting us to explore each of the sense doors, one after the other. Notice what's arising in the ear door. Notice when a sound arises and when a sound passes away. You know, you're inquiring into investigating the flux of experience, that everything is constantly changing. Notice the fact that it's changing. Anyway, so it, in some detail you can go through that, and it's a very comprehensive map of guided meditation, so to speak, to bring your attention to those aspects of experience that present themselves to meditative inquiry. Now, That's technology. But what's the work that it's doing? That's the tool that we use. Heightened awareness of what's actually going on in the present moment, rather than thinking, you know, more about the conceptual overload. But if that's the tool, what's the work that it's doing? What do the Buddhists do with that outlook on reality that is so unique and so challenging to us, but also at the same time so promising to us in terms of the wisdom that it can reveal? Well, one of the main issues that Buddhists face in all this, this sort of phenomenology of experience, as I would call it, simply paying attention to that which appears in experience and passes away. The question that inevitably comes up is, what is the self? Who am I? You know, where is... We have this notion of a self. We all have it. It's in our language. It's in our culture. It's in our literature. What is that, actually? Do we construe that properly or not? As you know, I don't have to be too mysterious about this. The Buddhists cut through a lot of that and say, basically, our colloquial understanding of self, our colloquial understanding of who we think we are, is actually inaccurate. And more to the point, they say, the inaccuracy of that understanding of ourselves is the core cause of all of our troubles. The source of suffering is the misconstrual of who we are. The reason we cause havoc in our world, both environmentally and to one another, and the harm that we do and so forth, comes from misunderstanding ourselves. The reason we can get miserable as individuals and our mental health can deteriorate and our integrity can deteriorate is because we don't understand ourselves in a very basic way. And if we can hone in on what is it that we misconstrue about ourselves, and if we can rectify that with a more accurate, more helpful view of ourselves, then that's going to make all the difference, the Buddha says. It's going to allow us to emerge from unwholesome patterns of behavior and generate wholesome ones. It's going to enable us to move from ignorance and destructive ways of looking at things to wisdom, cooperative way of looking at things. So what's that core analysis? Well, we know we have the sense of self, of being a self. Where does it come from? Well, one place it comes from is the body. We feel somehow like we are the person inhabiting the body. Why does that happen? Well, every time my body goes over there, I feel like I'm going over there. Every time my body flies somewhere else, it, you know, I was in Boston this morning. You know, now I'm in Minneapolis. There's something going on here. There's some connection between my body and my sense of self. So that's natural. Okay, the Buddhists aren't denying that that happens. You know, they're saying, okay, that happens. There is a sense of self as being the one who inhabits the body. A second sense of self, another source that we have for thinking of ourselves as the person, is what you might call the experiencer of pleasure and pain, the one who gets rewarded or punished, the one that either enjoys the pleasurable sensation or the one who experiences painful sensations. That the self is somehow bound up with the experience of pleasure and pain. That we are the one who enjoys the pleasure, and we are the one who suffers under or is victimized by the pain. So a sense of self is constructed around the experience of pleasure and pain. Quite naturally so. A third sense of self is what I call the artiste. That's not a Pali word. The artiste, that we feel like we are the person who is expressing ourselves. You know, that when we say something, when we say something unique, when we say something clever, when we construct something beautiful, it feels like we're a source of creativity, that we have the ability to articulate something that maybe has never been articulated before. Or take something that somebody else has expressed and put a twist or a nuance to it, add something to it. That the sense of expressing ourselves, especially as a unique person in our culture, it wasn't so important. The uniqueness wasn't so important in many other cultures, but it's very important in ours. That's part of our sense of self. We have the ability to express, and that seems to be a sense of the self. Another origin for our sense of self is we feel like we are the person who initiates action. I mean, there's got to be an agent in here somewhere, right? I mean, our language demands it. If decisions are made, then somebody has to make them. Unless you're caught in corporate wrongdoing, of course. Nobody was ever making the decision. The decisions were just made. But, you know, we have the sense that we are acting in the world, that we are an agent. We are someone who's deciding to do this. We decide to do some things that are right and helpful and wonderful. We decide to do some things that are horribly wrong and cruel and disastrous. And, you know, without that sense of agency, we wouldn't feel like we are justified in reaping the rewards of all the good we've done, or, you know, feel like we're suitably being punished for the harm that we've done. So the sense of being an agent that's acting in the world, that's the one who's doing it and the one who's experiencing the results of what we've done, that's one of the sources of self. And then finally, almost, we have a sense of somehow I am the one that consists of all of that. You know, everything that's happening is happening to me, by me. I myself is defined as that which consists of all these other things I've mentioned. You know, that I somehow feel embedded in the middle of it all. Not only the body, but, you know, all of it. Like the experience itself, the raw phenomenology of being aware of anything in the moment, that's where myself is. The self might not be my body or you know, the decisions I've made or whatever, but just as a pure essence of a node of consciousness, that's myself. All right, so you might notice by coincidence that I've given five explanations for the origin of self. And the Buddhists say all of those are natural. There's nothing wrong with them. But they say we read too much into what is merely a conglomeration of aggregates. Each of those five sources of self correspond to one of the aggregates. The sense of the person who inhabits this body, that's self derived from the experience of material form. And constructing the notion of the person who is experiencing pleasure and pain, that is merely arising from the aggregate of feeling. The Buddhists aren't saying that we don't have a body or that we don't have feelings. They're saying we do have a body, we do have feelings. But it's an extra step to go from the mere experience of the body, the experience of the feeling, to say the one who has the body, the one who experiences the feelings. What they're pointing to is that the sense of self is an added idea. It's a conceptual overlay. It's a habit of mind we've gotten into that we project onto experience. And, you know, the artiste or the one that's expressing, that's merely, the perception aggregate. Yes, we have a clever mind, we have a rich language, we have a whole symbolic vocabulary that we can use, visually symbolic, auditorially symbolic, you know, music, art, and so forth. And yes, that can be, you know, that can be used to express. But to say that there is a person who uses that apparatus to express, and that person is something other than the process of expression, is where they say we go too far. The fourth aggregate, of course, the one who does, that's simply formation, sankhara. Yes, there's an executive function in the brain. Yes, we can move our bodies and wiggle our tongues and say, you know, good and bad things and get into, you know, trouble or reap rewards. But that doesn't mean that there's a person standing outside of that decision-making who makes those decisions. And the consciousness, the final one, is yes, we have the node of conscious awareness, but as I said before, it's not necessarily unique to each one of us, and it's certainly not necessarily transcendent. So they're simply saying that within the experience of the five aggregates, we use that as a foundation, an explanation, an excuse for constructing this idea of the person who does all that. But that idea, they say, is not grounded in experience. Everything coming from the five aggregates is grounded in experience. You really do experience resistance. You really are dependent upon this body. If a little microbe does something wrong, you're going to die miserably, you know. Everything's got to be lined up just right in the material world, or else we've had it, you know. They're not denying that. And the same thing for all the others. They are aspects of human experience, but it is a mistake of interpretation to take all of that and construct the notion of the self over and above that. They simply say the self is embedded in all of that. It's not something outside of that, and that's not something that we own. Now, we don't seem to have a problem with this when it comes to anything else in nature. Why do we have a problem with this when it comes to ourselves? If somebody were asked, you know, who makes it rain, we'd say, oh, well, you know, people used to think that there were personalities up there that made it rain, the rain gods or the overlord or whatever. But now we understand that, you know, the high pressure system and the low pressure system and the clouds and the humidity and the temperature all come together in a certain way, and we have this kind of day. You know? It's not somebody making it do that. It just is a complex coming together of different circumstances. Now, why can't we say that about ourselves? The Buddhists are simply saying what makes us who we are is a complex co-arising of various circumstances. And when things come together in a certain way in a certain time, then Mark happens, you know? Mark isn't making it happen. Mark is the embodiment of it all happening. You know, when other things come together, and when happens, you know? I mean, it's simply shifting the language away from a language of possessiveness to a language of natural expression. And so the kicker to all this is when they say, well, what then is the source of my sense of having this idea that I exist as a self, as a unique and individual standing outside of so many of these conditions? They say the core origin of self is simply the habit of mind that we have in the midst of all of our experience to say, that is mine, that is me, that is myself. So if there's pain in the knee arising, we say, my knee is hurting. This pain is bothering me, you know, or anything else that goes on in our experience. It's a habit, it's a reflex, an unconscious reflex of our language, of our culture, of our psychology, to continually construe the experience of these five aggregates in terms of this imaginary person to whom it's happened and who owns it. And so we're constantly projecting onto it this sense of possessiveness. That's my knee, that's my car, that's my house, that's my wife, that's my cherished idea. Now, what's wrong with doing that? Well, the Buddha noticed that when that mechanism of projecting ownership onto something is active, trouble happens. And when it's not active, trouble doesn't happen. The simple example he gives is, you know, somebody's walking through the woods and somebody picks up a leaf and walks off with it. Does anybody get upset? No, they're just taking a leaf. It doesn't belong to anybody. But if somebody comes on my yard and takes my prize orchid, you know, that I've been nurturing and I'm attached to, then all hell breaks loose. And, you know, I want to kill that person and arrest them and beat them up and yell at them. And all this terrible stuff comes out of it. Because the sense of mine is being violated. You know? So everything we project a sense of ownership, this is me, this is what I consist of, my identity is deeply invested in this. Then when anybody threatens it or challenges it or questions it in any way, it evokes from us greed, hatred, and delusion. It's a fundamental delusion, but it evokes greed and hatred. Because the sense of being attached to what's mine evokes the greed, and the sense of having to defend what's mine from interpolators, or creating what's not me. These are the people that are outside my tribe, outside my ethnicity, outside my nationality, and so I hate them. I don't like them. I want them to go away. I don't want to deal with them. But if you don't have the overlay of that sense of ownership of to whom it belongs, then that mechanism isn't triggered. So they're simply saying that when we view things as self, we bring out the worst in ourselves and others. So what's the solution to that? It's painfully simple. View things as not self. And everything changes. Now, that doesn't mean, you don't exist and that, you don't still have a life and duties and responsibilities, and that doesn't mean that I can walk off of your car. Everything is just like it is, but you don't put this little twist on the end that, that's mine. You can go through your day saying, anger is arising. It's arising because of these circumstances. How can I change the circumstances so that the anger doesn't arise? Or injustice is arising. What are the conditions that are manufacturing that arising, that are supporting that arising of injustice? Well, maybe some of those things can be changed, Or annoyance is arising in my experience right now. Why am I being annoyed? Even if you change the language, why is annoyance arising? Well, usually it's because there's something I want to be different than it is. It's that sense of I want things to be a certain way. And if you adjust that, then it'll go away. So the Buddha is simply identifying that this core reflex to possess experience, that's to hold on to it, to grasp and hold in some way to a definition of self. And at the same time, by doing that, you're buying into a definition of what's not me, that is what I reject. What's not in the positive sense of not me, but in the sense of this is mine and that's my enemy, that's my adversary, that's my threat. And so inevitably, things like anxieties arise because we think about the things that are precious to me are might get threatened. Violence and hostilities arise because we militate in the direction of protecting what's ours, or to lash out against that which we identify as other or different from ourselves. And they're simply using the experiential psychology of direct observation of this is how the mind actually is set up to work, to reshape and recast our fundamental outlook on everything. And this is the difference it brings. In the standard view that we've all born into, either through the religious or the scientific or the cultural paradigms of our day, is there's a uniquely existing consciousness that is somehow a spiritual essence, transcendent of time and space, perhaps, or, a cause and effect, perhaps. And it has certain inalienable rights to ownership, of certain things and to having things a certain way. And it goes through its life defining what belongs to it and what's outside of its purview. And then its strategy for skillful survival has to do with protecting that's boundary. And we go through our lives that way. Personal psychological boundaries, broader cultural and national boundaries, and that's why our world is the way it is. We're triggering everybody else's greed, hatred, and delusion, and triggering our own greed, hatred, and delusion just because of the way we construe things. Now, we move from that, however, to this Buddhist view that's saying consciousness is not the starting point of the story. Consciousness is the last flourish. The sense of self is the last flourish that we put on at the end. The mind and body is capable of processing information, giving it a feeling tone, a perception. We've got habits that have developed that help us get through the day, a strategy and so forth. And then at the end of all of that, every single moment, we add this little flourish. And all of that is mine. And that's me. it's like the tail wagging the dog. You know, the dog is sitting there going through, and we're the little tail going behind. That's mine. That's mine. That's mine. But the influence of that little tweak that we put on things is causing all the harm. It's causing all the disappointment in our own lives. It's bringing out the worst of us, and it's helping us construct a world around the principles that bring out the worst in ourselves and others. And if we simply change that little piece, and starting with ourselves, starting with a breath, you know, what is it like to take a breath without feeling like you were the owner of that breath? What if instead you were merely, what we mean by you or me is simply interesting conscious awareness of the nuances of cessation that arise and pass away as this thing that is perceived as a breath is coming and going in experience, you know? And then from that, it goes out gradually and permeates the rest of our lives. This is the way we enter into our relationships, you know, into our professions, into our interactions with people. We're not losing much, if anything, because it's not taking away anything we already have. It's merely withdrawing the overlay, and it's that overlay, that conceptual overlay, that's causing all the trouble. So that, in a nutshell, is what I understand, you know, the core insight of the Buddha was. And I think that, you know, he laid this all out in the very earliest literature. I think that basic orientation stands throughout all the different Buddhist traditions. A lot of Buddhism, you know, adds some, you know, significant flourishes on top of that, but I don't think any of them really repudiate that. It's one, look directly at experience instead of modeling conceptually about it. Two, understand the dynamics of it, how it's all interrelated. And three, understand the way that you construct the sense of self when it's out of a series of misconstrues of reality. And fourth, learn how to let go of that constructed sense of self. And you'll be much better off for it, and so will everyone else. So do you need to stretch, or do you need to leave early? I'm happy to answer questions or you know, any other comments or thoughts that anybody might have. Feel free to speak up.
A little odd. As you're talking about consciousness in this way, I think that we have some really good evidence that there are a number of animal species that seem to have where they can identify themselves. They have a sense of this is mine. And given this model, is there anything that is uniquely human about consciousness that we might not see, say, in some of the primates or whales or animals that seem to exhibit a high degree of self-awareness?
I suspect that the differences in consciousness have to do with complexity and scope rather than a difference in kind. I think if by consciousness we simply mean the processing of information, which is, you know, then even a fly is conscious. You know, a fly will fly in, avoid all the obstacles, land on the food, and go off. And it needs to take in information and react in real time to do that. I think that's consciousness. And it's got neural systems that allow it to do it. Different from a plant that's, you know, reacting to light or warmth and so forth. And so I think all the animals have consciousness. I think it's fundamentally similar to ours. But there must be something that's happening when ours has so many more neurons and is so much more complex. There may be some considerable difference of capability or scope or depth to our consciousness that the animals don't. But I think the crux of your question has less to do with consciousness and more to do with what the Buddhists are calling formations. You know, I think every species inherits genetically certain fundamental codes on how to survive in the world. All of them are probably rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, I think that's really what got us to this point of survival. Greed and hatred, at least, are, I think, adaptive qualities. I think they were necessary at a certain primitive level of existence for animals to survive. You know, the greed gets you to chase down and eat your food, and the hatred gives you the strength to fight off your enemies or run away from them and so forth. But I think, and then, you know, mammals get another set of programs that the reptiles didn't have around nurturing the young and cooperating and self-sacrifice for the good of the herd and so forth, and we've inherited all of that. But then there's some other stuff that we have on top of that. I don't know the particular studies you're referring to, so whether the animals really have a sense of ownership or whether we're projecting that onto the data, I'm not sure, but I certainly would agree that they have highly developed social skills, and I think their consciousness is essentially the same as ours.
Would it conclude saying that some of them have a sense of self? The sort of things we talked about here with how we identify with things, is there a reason to rule that out?
No, I wouldn't say there's a reason to rule it out. They could well have a sense of self. That's where the delusion part comes in, I think. It's, I think that all species are capable of it. They're just particularly good at it.
Yes. Could you just say how the unconditioned relates to
activism? The question is, how does the unconditioned relate to all this? The short answer, I don't know. I really don't understand sometimes how that notion, the unconditioned, is being used in Buddhist circles. And I think a lot of it is incomprehensible. That is to say that, again, from my reading of the Pali Canon, the earliest literature, what the Buddha means by the unconditioned, and he says this very specifically in a number of places, is the cessation of greed, hatred, and delusion. That it's, you know, early Buddhism was really about a psychological solution to a psychological problem. The problem is that people had all this greed, hatred, and delusion. The solution was developing the mind to a extent that you see the insight of the selflessness of it all, the impermanence of it all, the suffering of it all, and once and for all, the need to possess or hold on to or push anything away is gone. And nirvana, or awakening, was something that was used as an adjective of a person. You know, the person who has become awakened, in whom the defilements have been extinguished. And so it really wasn't anything more than a psychological transformation, a radical psychological transformation that the Buddha had under the tree. And most of the early things that he said after his awakening experience had all to do with finding peace and letting go of anger and hatred and all the rest of it. Is Buddhist theology developed after the passing away of the Buddha? I think there was much more emphasis upon cosmology and ontology. You know, what is it that really exists and not? And so the notion of the unconditioned took on, I think, a larger importance and a different vocabulary than it originally had. I find it largely confusing to talk about the early material from the perspective of some of those other views of it. But, you know, I guess I'm on record, so I can't do anything about that. But it's worth saying, it's a very minority opinion, my saying this. I mean, it's not many people agree with me on that. Yes?
You were talking about the ancients and their early adopting of just the sensory experience. At the same time, while the time frame, roughly, that actual period, over what I call it the early Judeo world, they were having a different reality of spiritual world where everything seemed to have a cause and effect in terms of offending or not offending, or it was some tie into what they were doing. You know, it's a pretty stark contrast between the two. Is the contrast as stark as it sounds? And then is there any insight between how this bifurcation is moving?
Yeah, I think, again, this is a minority opinion, but I think the differences are that stark. I think going back 5,000 years, there were four great civilizations in the world: Egyptian, Mesopotamian, Indus Valley, and China. And that the Indus Valley had a unique perspective, very introspective. They didn't put any of their energy into monuments of stone or things of the afterlife. The whole archaeological remains of that era, we don't have a literature, but the archaeology really is suggesting a radical de-emphasis of the external world. And, you know, we do have some very ancient pictures of people appearing to be sitting in meditative poses. And we have some constructs in Indian religion around rebirth and meditation and asceticism and purification of consciousness and awakening, all of which is erupting in Indian civilization that didn't come from the Indo-Europeans. See, I don't know about the Judaic strand of it, but certainly the Indo-Europeans, which had a very outward-looking spirituality, the gods are up there and we communicate by fire, you know, through a priestly class of professionals and so forth, that came into the Indus Valley around 2000 BCE. There was a migration, possibly even a conquest, of the Indus Valley civilization by Westerners. And so the Hinduism that has come to develop in India is primarily a Western religious tradition that's been informed and come into contact with a lot of this indigenous material, which is why the Hindus were able to incorporate in the Upanishads a lot of the interior arts and so forth, and Yoga Sutra and so forth. But by and large, I think ancient India had a very different fundamental outlook than the West did. And I think a lot of what came to be dominant even in India had its origins in Western thinking.
Develop a sense of self that's separate from the other and so on. It seems that implicit in love is the notion of community and the notion of collective of individuals that human beings are born into. And so I was trying to identify that in the various parts of your talk, because for many, the sense of self develops in relationship with the other. And that's what's early inculcated in them within the context of human culture, nation, society, etc.
Yes.
That on the one hand, and then on the other hand, psychoanalysis also talks about the self developing its own sense of itself through the mirror stage and so on. And I was wondering if you could address those various, those other ways of seeing the constitution of the self.
Yes, again, I think the development of the self is a natural thing, you know. The Buddhists say it's a basic mistake, but it's not one that can necessarily be corrected in childhood, you know. I defer to the considerable knowledge that's come out of modern psychology on developmental issues, and I think it's crucial for healthy people to develop the sense of self and ego and even some of the primitive urges that help, you know, define that and so forth. But the Buddhists are talking about, you know, ordinary human unhappiness being an arrested stage of development, and that, you know, you can evolve beyond that. And I think a lot of all traditions, all religious traditions are basically trying to do that, I think, and Buddhists in particular. So it's not that the sense of self is an evil thing, but it's something that we naturally develop as a species, that we naturally develop as a child, and that's a natural part of our social institutions insofar as they manifest these days. But they're saying that, you know, we've evolved to the stage where our own instincts are now our greatest threat, our greatest predator, so to speak, as a species. And I think, you know, really that the Buddha was pointing to the next stage of evolution, where it is possible to keep the best of what we've developed in our programming as human beings, in our psychology, but really be able to overcome the worst of it. So this dramatic transformation that he experienced under the Bodhi tree may well be construed as a kind of radical rewiring of the brain, even. But certainly as someone working within whatever they receive from their culture and their upbringing, and then trying to get, you know, beyond that, rather than trying to get. I wouldn't suggest any social experimentation where we try to take a bunch of 1-year-olds and raise them with non-self. You know, I'm not sure that would be such a good idea. But it is natural, but many things in our natural world are toxic. And the Buddha is simply noticing that some of the instincts that have gotten us here and that make our world go are toxic and do more harm than good. And if there's a way that we can purify our minds and hearts of some of these toxins and become better people, then we'll make a better world for it. And it's not sort of putting down what we're doing, but it's trying to get us to the next step, I think. Yes.
Introspection is a big point here. And within that framework of introspection, is usually one's mind being introspective. Is there any place at all within this framework which seems very, very associated with investigation of natural states of the mind and others? Is there any space in here at all for what would traditionally be called spirituality or the sacred?
I think that at its most profound, one of the things that the Buddhist psychologists are teaching us is that all meaning is constructed. All experience is constructed, and therefore all human meaning is constructed. I think that as an idea, as an experience of the sacred, it can be a very positive thing. I think what the Buddha was pointing out was, and again, this isn't necessarily the mainstream reading of his teaching, was that to feel in the presence of the sacred may bring out a lot of positive mental states, and that's a good thing, but that doesn't necessarily mean that sacred is the way we construe it to be. I mean, what Buddhism is notorious for among world religions, at least in some circles, is, you know, basically it's non-theistic. I mean, there are gods and deities aplenty, but, you know, they're relatively limited. And so there are times when, you know, they can evoke certain emotions that can be either bad for us or good for us. It can bring out what's wholesome or unwholesome in us. I mean, a lot of the unwholesomeness in our world is inspired by, religious thinking. And a lot of what's most beautiful in human experience is also inspired by religious thinking. So they place the emphasis less upon what is the ontological status of the sacred other, and they put it rather on what is the psychological attitude one has when one is constructing experience. And from that perspective, I think it can be very beneficial to construct that experience. But as I said, the Buddha, as I read him, wasn't really concerned with saying so much what's really out there or not. He's saying, you know, we're constructing a world of meaning within this fathom-long body through the sense doors and the aggregates and so forth, and we have our hands full understanding how we're doing that and trying to make it as wholesome as possible, that largely speculating about the nature of reality, so to speak, beyond our own experience is not generally productive or necessary. That's his perspective on it, as I read it. Yes?
I'm having trouble figuring out how you jump to, from what I know of Buddhism, to the idea that that the Buddha had social implications in what he was learning by his introspection, because my understanding is he started with the question of dukkha, suffering, and it was all internal, his learning about the world. and then teaching me that, you know, people wanted to know how to change, and you became a teacher, and you taught people to be, to have what he had inside. But I don't understand the idea of, you know, fixing the world.
Changing the world, yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. The Buddha did not have an overt social agenda in the sense that he was trying to go out there and change things. But what he did say consistently from the beginning, that his engaging in the practice of his own purification to begin with, and certainly his enterprise of teaching for the rest of his life, was motivated by compassion for the well-being of all living beings, you know, of others. And he had, had the strong sense in the early perspective that you can't, it's not going to be effective to try to change other people. You know, if somebody's doing something bad, we say, well, we got to go out there and make them stop doing that, you know. The Buddha was instead was saying, you only have direct access to your own mind and body. And again, you've got your hands full trying to sort that out. But if you are able to do this inner process of purification, even whether you completely succeed at it or even if you try diligently at the lower end of trying, it's going to have an effect on others. And so the agenda is not so much changing the world, the agenda is changing oneself. And yes, I'm updating it a little bit by saying, you know, it's worthwhile by changing ourselves to change the world we live in. But again, you do it through personal psychological transformation rather than by social action. Early Buddhism was not a particularly socially active thing, movement. Except in its, you know, I mean, it had some unusual features, like, you know, its treatment of the castes and the equality of women in the early orders and so forth. But, it, you know, notoriously the Buddha would stand aside when some kings did some pretty nasty things to one another, and he didn't step up and say, well, you shouldn't do that. You know, but again, as I understand it, it has to do with this ripple effect. He does speak quite eloquently about how each of us as lay people in particular are embedded in a matrix of social relationships. And if we attend carefully to the quality of those relationships, we'll be safe and free of danger. So how you treat your spouse, how you treat your parents, how you treat the people that work for you, how you treat your teachers and your friends and so forth. By cultivating very carefully wholesome qualities in those relationships, you'll evoke the wholesome qualities from other people, and then you, not only as an individual, but in your circle, will be much better off. In the same way, he talks about integrity, or sila, virtue, as a form of, as a gift, as a form of generosity. That by a person trying to be have moral integrity, they are bringing safety to the people that depend on them or that come in contact with them. So yes, there's a lot of emphasis upon personal transformation, but as I read it, it was always placed in the context of that being for the benefit of others. And so it wasn't directly go out and change others, but there was a strong sense of working toward the well-being of all. Yes?
Kind of related question. I'm wondering if you've given this talk to a mixed group, and by that I mean people of different races, different economic classes, social classes, that kind of thing, which is usually fairly uncommon to find, I've found anyway, within Buddhist circles. But I'm thinking that some people who are more aware of their lack of agency in society might put up more resistance to giving that up or to rethinking it the way you're talking about it, and that people who are certainly not terribly conscious of agency because it's taken for granted because of their social status, it might be easier to do that in certain situations, but then become more difficult when the rubber hits the road.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That is the case. I haven't had much experience in talking with mixed populations. There's been a steady stream of, some diversity coming through there, but not a lot. So I have heard from time to time that different communities will hear these teachings in very different ways, but I don't have a lot of personal experience. So, yes?
This whole idea of evolving the self, it seems to me that as we go in and do our work and do our personal transformation, this ripple effect is changing our actual identity.
Yes.
Can you speak to how you see that happening in this modern time and maybe even the next step?
Well, again, I find myself in the wilderness in saying this generally, but I have great hope for the human race. I think we're doing pretty darn good, and I think we're getting better all the time. I know it doesn't seem like that sometimes because our world is pretty screwed up, but compared to how screwed up it used to be, I think it's much better. And I think a lot of the reasons it's as screwed up as it is because there's just so many of us and our tools and our weapons are so powerful. But in terms of the evolution of the human heart, you know, its sensitivity, its intelligence, its understanding, its empathy, I think by and large we're on an incline of improving. You know, a lot of really barbaric cruelty was taken for granted for so many years in so many places. And yes, there's still plenty of pockets of that here and there, but I think the number of good people in the world far outweighs the number of terrible people in the world. And I think a lot of that has to do with just the cumulative effect of individual transformation. I mean, as people live in gradually less, have over the last few hundred years lived in gradually less desperate circumstances, as the level of education has improved, as the level of human rights has improved, and so forth. And of course, it's not perfect, and there's lots of counterexamples. But by and large, I think that as individuals become more wholesome and more wise, then the communities they live in become more wholesome and wise, which then influence the next generation to become more wholesome and wise. And I think, again, in the biggest picture, I think we are improving. And if we can survive the next few episodes that we're bound to face over the next couple of centuries, I think we may well make it through to the
outside. So is self-actually evolving because of the heart? Because there is definitely this walking the self and the vehicle, sort of letting go. How do I deal with my greed, my love, that
versus,
you know, ego,
punish, strip down. Yeah. Well, the Buddhists have a very simple model. You know, in the human heart, and they use heart and mind interchangeably because it's the same word in Sanskrit, there are three wholesome roots and three unwholesome roots. We have greed, hatred, and delusion, which is the cause of all of our problems. There's no problem we face in the world that is not rooted in somebody's greed, hatred, and delusion. I mean, things are the way they are because people are acting badly. People are greedy. People are hateful. People are ignorant. But we also have, each of us, three wholesome roots: non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. That's the widest way they could put it. I mean, by non-greed, it includes things like generosity and renunciation. Non-hatred, of course, is loving kindness and compassion. And non-delusion is wisdom, insight, understanding. So I think these are fairly universal categories. They're below all culture and all individuals and so forth. This is fairly generic to the human being. And as people, each moment to moment, are able to choose the slightly more wholesome over the slightly more unwholesome option at any given moment, it represents an incremental advance. Now, you can see this in individuals. There are people that, you know, have emerged from, you know, terrible violence or addiction or trauma or whatever, and have become very, you know, compassionate, empathic, you know, people. sometimes the reverse happens as well. But basically, this Buddhist model of personality, of self, is radically malleable. It's saying that we are not essentially one way or the other. We are whatever we make ourselves become, or whatever the causes and conditions, the circumstances we encounter make us become. And so if we can work to make incremental changes, moment to moment, over a long period of time, we can bring about radical transformation. There is nothing fixed in our personality. And even a very terrible person can become a wonderful person, and vice versa. So I think, you know, I think that's hopeful. I prefer a radically malleable sense of self that is capable of radical improvement over a model that says, you know, certain people are just evil and certain people are just good, and that's just the way it is, you know. So I have hope. Yes?
I have one more question.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry.
You kind of referenced a text that I've been trying to find called Tarukasana Rustic Jhana by Ajahn Ram Victor, and I don't have the name for that. And I'm wondering if you could spell the name and kind of take it to the book, or...
I'm sorry, I missed the pronunciation. What's it called?
How Vipassana Rustic Jhana.
Yes. The History of Mindfulness. Ajahn Brahm. No, not Ajahn Brahm. Sujata. Bhikkhu Sujata.
Okay.
It's available for free download on the web. Yeah. He's an Australian monk. And it's a technical book, but an excellent one. And if you type in The History of Mindfulness, I'm sure you'll get there, and you can download it for free.
One
more, yes.
It kind of fascinates me that, you know, we can all be speaking English and have totally different understandings about what some terms mean. So I'm like responding to the whole idea of, I don't know if I can recapture the language, the woman right there in Kara was speaking and asking about social
agency.
Okay. So, from my point of view, if an individual really goes through a transformation, that if they begin to act from that change in the world that they live in, they can't help but be engaged in social action. There's just no way around that. Because if what's negative comes from those three things that you refer to, if you step out of that, you are bound to be transforming those around you.
Yes. Yes, I completely agree.
Challenging the social institutions and what's behind them.
It turns out that the more unwholesome stuff, greed, hatred, and delusion, tends to be more isolating and, disengaged. And the more wholesome ones, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, have to do with responding compassionately where you see suffering and wanting to give to others and reach out to others and so forth. So I agree that as the quality of the formations, shall we say, increases and improves, it has the natural effect of people being more open to helping one another and working towards the positive change. I agree. So let's all do that, shall we? Breath by breath, moment by moment, let's totally transform ourselves and let it ripple out and transform the world, and maybe a few generations from now, it'll all be a wonderful place. Thank you.
And thanks again, Andy, for coming. Great to have you here. Hopefully it won't be the last time.